content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And our first story today is actually a book review. It's entitled American Suburbs Have a Financial Secret. And this is written by Michael Waters, who is a writer based in New York City. One Sunday morning in March of 1949, a group of nearly 300 people, clutching deck chairs and sleeping bags, lined up to buy new homes in what had, until recently, been a stretch of potato fields in central Long Island. They hoped to move to fabulous Levittown, as its developer, William J. Levitt, had branded his creation, more than 17,000 gleaming homes in an all-white community with freshly dug wells and newly paved roads. But that was the extent of the neighborhood. Levitt's profits were in home sales, not city planning. In fact, his namesake had hardly any public infrastructure, and Levittown's new political leaders needed to come up with money for maintenance, trash, and schools. So they took a gamble and decided to enter the municipal bond market. Selling bonds, essentially issuing buyers an IOU plus interest, is a quick way for a government to raise funds. You or someone you know probably owns a U.S. Treasury bond. But institutional investors, a mix of insurance companies, mutual funds, and private equity firms, buy bonds too, including from local governments and school districts. Cities get money up front, and buyers are assured that they'll turn a profit. This win-win proposition made many post-war suburbs take the plunge into the bond market. Throughout the 1950s, as private developers rapidly constructed new suburbs, school districts in Nassau County, where Levittown is located, increased their debt load by sixfold to meet the needs of their new residents. The problem was, not every town and city was treated the same. Credit rating agencies saw richer locales as very likely to repay their debts and gave them sweet deals on interest rates, which meant that these towns owed less to those who'd bought their bonds. The poorer places got shortchanged. Municipal debt is a secret American pastime, defining and dividing suburbs across the United States. In his new book, Cracked Foundations, Debt and Inequality in Suburban America, the urban historian Michael Glass looks behind the marketing that attracted flocks of Americans to places like Levittown, and uses debt as a lens through which to understand suburban disparities. The U.S. is one of the only countries in the world where municipalities raise money primarily through bonds, and their differential treatment on the private market has quietly driven inequality across the nation. Saddled with higher interest rates on their bonds, people in poor cities and towns today pay double the amount in property taxes, often suffer higher home foreclosure rates, and wield paltier education budgets compared with their wealthier counterparts. Major cities face the consequences of municipal bonds, too. Chicago famously leased its parking meters to investors in order to pay off its debts. But they employ teams of bond experts to negotiate the best terms. Small cities and towns, whose bond coordinator is often a single financial manager juggling dozens of other tasks, can do less to protect themselves from high interest rates. America's cities have been taking on debt for more than 200 years. New York City issued one of the first municipal bonds in 1817 in order to bankroll the construction of the Erie Canal. Soon after, selling bonds became a popular way for new cities to attract railroads. They would offer to subsidize the cost of building a new train stop, but they needed cash to do it. By the 1950s, as Glass shows, neglectful developers left new suburbs with little choice but to fund their expansion via the bond market. Cities have only become more reliant on that debt since, especially after President Richard Nixon slashed federal aid to cities in the early 1970s. Although municipalities in other countries can borrow from their national government, Canada regularly provides localized loans to stimulate housing construction. American cities and towns usually don't have that luxury. Instead, they have found themselves play-acting as entrepreneurs, courting public investment to fund basic services. Over the course of a 30-year term, Glass estimates, the fees and interest on bonds add 30 to 60% in costs beyond the original borrowed amount. Every town pays extra, but some pay more than others. The math is both simple and opaque. Whenever a local government offers a bond for sale, the three major credit rating agencies, Moody's, S&P, and Fitch, assess the government's likelihood of repayment. A municipality that seems certain to repay gets a high score. One with shakier prospects gets a weaker score. Investors then set interest rates based on these assessments. Think of the grade as a credit score for your city. The worse it is, the higher your interest rate, and the more you end up paying for pretty much everything. Credit rating agencies claim that they measure objective conditions, but they base their grades on factors including median household income, tax revenue, and home ownership rates that reward already wealthy communities and can create disparities based on the demographics of their residents. The UCLA professor Justin McBride, for example, recently sampled the credit ratings of small cities and towns across California and concluded that the larger the white population was in a municipality, the better the credit rating that municipality received. Back in 1949, when Levittown first issued municipal bonds to fund its school system, Moody's analysts dismissed it as an unseasoned residential area with an element of insecurity, Glass writes. Moody's assigned Levittown a BAA rating, which meant that the city was a lower medium grade risk that warranted a 2.7% interest rate. Meanwhile, Glass goes on to show, Moody's assigned nearby Great Neck, a wealthy enclave and the site of a major manufacturing plant, an A rating, resulting in an interest rate of 2.3%. Nearly a decade later, when Levittown officials issued bonds yet again, Moody's warned investors that the city was a, quote, hazardous investment environment, end quote, and Levittown bonds were purchased at 4.3%. A month later, Great Neck once again got a better deal, bonds at 3.5%. These minor rate differences continued to grow over time. On, say, a 10-year, $5 million bond, Levittown might theoretically end up paying close to $600,000 more to its creditors than Great Neck would. Levittowners weren't naive. School officials wrote to the state of New York to request public aid for construction, Glass discovered in the state's Education Department archives. But they received little support, which pushed them toward selling bonds to private buyers. By 1957, Levittown was spending 16% of its annual school budget on debt service, more than the salaries of all of its junior high and high school teachers combined. As Glass writes, with each bond issue, Levittown and Great Neck grew further apart. In Long Island, Levittown, a mostly white middle-class area, was far from the worst off. In 1976, the majority black hamlet of Roosevelt issued bonds to fund its schools. Roosevelt agreed to pay 11.25% in annual interest at the time, when the median interest on other bonds was less than 7%. The money was a lifeline in the short term and devastating over time. To meet its debt payments, Roosevelt expected to raise its property taxes by 10% over the following decade. Many residents were forced to move out. Others, unable to pay, defaulted on their home. By 1980, people in Roosevelt were paying 11% more in property taxes than their neighbors in Great Neck were, even though Great Neck had four times more wealth. Persistent debt has only widened this gap in the decades since. Today, Glass notes, Great Neck has eight times more wealth than Roosevelt has, yet its residents pay 51% less in property taxes. Debt is still quietly shaping the fortunes of small cities and towns across America. Public schools, in particular, have become so reliant on bond sales to fund salaries and services that overall school debt more than doubled from 2002 to 2019, rising to $500 billion. These bonds can take decades for a district to pay off. In one extreme case, a California school district ponied up $34.3 million in lifetime payments on a $16.7 million bond that it had taken out in 2005, more than double the amount it originally borrowed. Disproportionately high property taxes are one telltale sign of a city trapped in a cycle of municipal debt, and so are weak public services, underfunded schools, underpaid teachers, aging recreation centers, sewer systems in need of an upgrade. Even over-policing is downstream of these local bonds. Consider, for instance, Ferguson, Missouri, which took on millions of dollars in debt in the 1960s and 70s to fund new infrastructure projects. Those payments proved incapacitating, and within a few decades, many of Ferguson's white citizens had fled, leaving a cohort of newly arrived black residents to foot the bill. The city soon relied on a new revenue stream, aggressive ticketing, which so disproportionately affected black residents that the Department of Justice investigated and in 2015 found the practice discriminatory. This bond debt is part of an American tradition of leaving public service funding to private actors and has become a primary vehicle of suburban inequality. In Disillusioned, published last year, the journalist Benjamin Harold tracks how the school district in his middle-class Pennsylvania suburb of Penn Hills ended up $172 million in debt, leading to mass furloughs, service reductions, and inevitably higher property taxes. Although Harold blames, in part, the magical thinking of the school board that approved the huge bonds in the first place, these administrators had only so many choices. Private debt has become an unavoidable part of local governance. As a solution, some advocates have suggested that the Federal Reserve lend money to school districts and municipalities at no interest. The Fed has, in the past, said it doesn't have the authority to do this. But until other options become available, poor cities and towns will just end up further and further behind, making bets they can never win. Next, blaming foreigners for American failings won't fix them. Railing against Ukraine, Israel, and other outsiders is easy. Solving problems at home is not. This was written by Yair Rosenberg. If there's one belief that unites Americans across the political spectrum, it's that other countries are the reason we can't have nice things. We sent $250 billion to Ukraine, the late conservative activist Charlie Kirk wrote on X in January, and yet we can't get water to fight fires in California. In 2023, Assemblyman and now New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani told an audience at a Democratic Socialists of America conference that we have to make clear that when the boot of the NYPD is on your neck, it's been laced by the IDF, referring to the Israeli army. Housing and insurance across the board are extremely high and becoming out of reach for many, Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene posted in July. We do not want to give or sell weapons to Ukraine or be involved in any foreign wars or continue the never-ending flow of foreign aid. Some progressive activists have gone so far as to blame federal assistance for Israel for local budget cuts to New York City libraries. For many Americans and their elected officials, foreign actors, whether Ukrainian, Israeli, or Chinese, are parasites who stand in the way of prosperity or otherwise corrupt the country. And to be fair, America's international posture under this administration and the previous ones certainly leaves much to critique. But when lashing out becomes a substitute for looking inward, such criticism devolves into conspiracism, a way to pin domestic problems on outsiders so as to avoid reckoning with their real causes at home. This rhetorical move may generate applause from partisans, but it's self-defeating, because societies that externalize their internal issues will fail to fix them. Take the wildfires in Los Angeles earlier this year. At the time, Kirk and other conservatives implied that the failure to prevent the devastation and deal with its aftermath was partly the result of America sending aid to Ukraine. But the facts told a different story. As one of the wealthiest and highest tax states in the country, and the fifth largest economy in the world, California had the resources to address the perils posed by wildfires. Local authorities just failed to adequately prepare for a sadly predictable emergency. Any effort to avert a similar catastrophe in the future needs to reckon with this reality, not divert the debate to activities overseas. Indeed, setting aside entirely the merits of U.S. support for Ukraine or Israel, those outlays are a rounding error in the American budget. Both countries could disappear tomorrow, and America's healthcare situation, education system, law enforcement challenges, and disaster preparedness would remain the same, because America's predicament is the consequence of American political choices, not sinister foreigners hoodwinking the masses. Similarly, Mondami's suggestion that radicalized police brutality perpetrated in America, established in 1776 by the NYPD, established in 1845, stems from Israel, established in 1948, is an offense against not just U.S. history, but also basic causality. Sourcing such violence to a handful of police exchange trips to Israel for counterterrorism training isn't just factually wrong. It ensures the actual drivers of the violence go unaddressed and conveniently offloads a long-standing American pathology onto outsiders. When he becomes mayor in January, Mondami may end the NYPD's Israel trips, but he will be left with the same local problem. That's because most American ills are of our own making, the result of political choices, trade-offs, and citizen preferences. Many people struggle to find affordable housing because of constraining policies in New York City, California, and other blue strongholds. At this moment, many Americans are facing the loss of their SNAP benefits because of decisions made at the federal level to shut down the government, to fund its services, and prevent an emergency fund from offsetting the shortfall. The country doesn't have Medicare for all because Americans are unwilling to pay the estimated $20 trillion it would cost per decade, not because the approximately $500 billion we've sent to Ukraine and Israel over the course of those countries' entire existence. Simply put, these situations prevail not because foreign actors defrauded America for the budgetary equivalent of pocket change, but because of policy choices made democratically here at home, for good and for ill. America's new wave of populist politicians are right to highlight the failings of the country's elite, both here and abroad. But if they resort to exporting blame for America's shortfalls in housing, healthcare, and other areas rather than taking a hard look within, they will have only quack cures to treat very real ailments. Our third story. We're thinking about young adulthood all wrong. This was written by Meg J. The notion that your 20s are the best years of your life is more rumor than reality. It shows up in songs, films, ads, social media posts, but it says more about Americans' idealization of youth than it does about what it actually feels like to be young today. The 2024 World Happiness Report found that when American adults were asked to rate the extent to which they were living their, quote, best possible life, end quote, those over 60 answered the most positively, followed by 45 to 59-year-olds. People younger than 30 trailed behind. Still, the idea that young adults might be at peak happiness is tough to shake, a cliche passed down by older people who know better. A 2021 YouGov poll found that the group most likely to think that their 20s would be their best years are 18 to 19-year-olds who haven't yet experienced them. For 25 years, I've worked as a developmental clinical psychologist specializing in 20-somethings. Often when I tell people about my work, their responses are dismissive or confused. They wonder what young people, without the challenges of partners or kids or mortgages or aging bodies, could be so unhappy about. But 20-somethings are the least likely group to have the things that make people happy and healthy: secure homes and careers, stable love lives and friendships. What they do have is more than their share of firsts and worsts with respect to jobs, bosses, relationships, breakups, roommates, and apartments. It's rough, and it's gotten rougher. Rates of depression and anxiety among 20-somethings spiked during the early coronavirus pandemic. Nevertheless, young adults have long been more likely than older adults to struggle with their mental health, at least since I saw my first client in 1999. Over the past three decades, adult sources of stability have become more and more likely to be realized in one's 30s rather than in one's 20s. Today's young workers will have, on average, 9 different jobs by age 37. Only about 40% of American adults under 30 say they find their work fulfilling or enjoyable, while almost a quarter say it is overwhelming. According to the Pew Research Center, the current crop of young adults is better educated and better paid than their late 20th century counterparts. Yet, as of 2024, fewer than half of 25 to 29-year-olds were completely financially independent, and only 2/3 of people in their early 30s were, at least in part because of student debt. The road toward occupational and financial security is long and winding, and this affects life outside of work as well. It contributes to the fact that, contrary to what Instagram posts may lead us to believe, young adulthood can be the loneliest time of life. 20-somethings are the group most likely to move in any given year, often to follow a job or look for a better one, leaving friends and support systems scattered. And with only half married by 35, young adults spend much of their life between families, no longer in their childhood home, but not yet in the one they'll create on their own. The median age of first-time home buyers, which was 28 in 1991, is now at an all-time high of 40. The uncertainty that goes along with not having adult sources of safety and not knowing if you ever will is hardly fun. The brain interprets uncertainty as danger. In recent years, researchers have discovered that uncertainty is a stressor that puts us at risk for a wide variety of mental health concerns, including anxiety, depression, eating disorders, and suicidality. As one 20-something client put it, "I don't have a lot of knowns in my life." What many 20-somethings do feel sure of is that they're falling far behind peer, parental, and societal expectations when it comes to meeting adult milestones. One 29-year-old told me that she felt like she was failing because she was single and didn't have a more prestigious job. A 27-year-old man explained his hopelessness this way. People used to have a house and a spouse by now. I see it in the news all the time. So do I in research and articles that persist in referencing the norms of 1975. Comparing what's happening now with what life looked like half a century ago, an era that wasn't so great for everyone, isn't helping anyone. Neither is diagnosing generations and blaming their phones. I'm no fan of social media, nor are most of my clients and students, but young people have bigger problems. In a 2024 survey of university presidents, 86% named social media as one of the most important drivers of college mental health woes, compared with only 33% of students themselves. Young adults were more likely to point to the struggle to balance schoolwork with personal, financial, and familial duties. Telling young adults that if they just put their phone down, they'd solve things, or that something's wrong with them if they're not happy, only adds to their concerns. If you want to help a 20-something, have some empathy for the uncertainties they wake up to each day and show them the data about what's ahead. In a 2022 study of adults in the United States, happiness and satisfaction increased across every decade of adulthood, from the late teens to the 70s and beyond. So did every other measure of well-being, including close relationships, financial stability, meaning and purpose, and mental health. Importantly, this study and others have found a similar upward slope in well-being, including data from the earliest generation said to have delayed adult milestones, Gen Xers, who are now in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. Young adults may no longer have work and love sorted out in their 20s, but they can use their early adult years to build the kinds of skills and relationships they will still feel good about as they age. This is what we ought to be telling them. They're not delayed or damaged or doomed. They're digging in. I don't expect my 20-something clients to have it all. I do expect them, and 20-somethings everywhere, to become happier and healthier over time as they become more likely to have and do what makes people happier and healthier. This message matters because young adults who have hope for the future are less likely to feel anxious and depressed. They're more likely to eat well, exercise, and set goals and work toward them. If you don't believe the hype that they are supposed to be in their best years of your life, you won't panic when they're not. I tell my clients that if their 20s turn out to be the best years of their life, something has gone seriously wrong. Life can and does get better as you go. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.